of news and information. Hello there. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, anticipation grows about this week's special counsel testimony on the Russia investigation as President Trump takes aim.
Robert Mueller, I know he's conflicted. There's a lot of conflicts that he's got, including the fact that his best friend is Comey. But he's got conflicts with me, too. He's got big conflicts with me.
Protests continue for a 10th straight day in the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, where residents are demanding the governor resign. Also ahead, the American musician known as Papa Funk has died. It's all on today's International Edition. House Republicans and Democrats seem to agree that former special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony this week could be pivotal in shifting public opinion on the question of holding President Trump accountable about what happened during the 2016 election with regard to Russian meddling. President Trump says Democrats are wasting their time by having Mueller testify.
You can't take all those bites out of the apple. We had no collusion, no obstruction. We had no nothing. We had a total no collusion finding.
Republicans say they'll focus on making clear Mueller's report represents a final episode in the Russia probe. Democrats hope this clearly shows evidence of wrongdoing by Trump in a potentially last-ditch bid to impeach him. Joining us to talk more about what will likely happen in Wednesday's testimony is former Central Intelligence Agency officer and criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, why is Trump still trying to discredit Mueller even as his attorney general throws shade on the report?
The president knows that Mueller has the potential of taking him down. This is his soft underbelly. If the Democrats can lay out a legitimate argument that Trump did bad things in a laundry list, which Mueller has, by the way, in these 400 plus pages of this document, if they can get that in a way that the American people will feel it viscerally, The president could be concerned, should be concerned.
The Department of Justice also kind of leaning on Mueller now. Attorney General William Barr seems to be more in the corner of Trump. You know, he's just been having his back, so to speak, for quite a while now. He did send Mueller an actual letter telling him he must not go outside of the boundaries of this report and not discuss third-party individuals that were not charged. Would that also mean the president?
What DOJ is trying to do is box Mueller in and say, you can testify about the four corners of this document. That's basically how you would say in legal parlance. They don't want to say anything beyond that. In other words, they don't want his opinions. They don't want to talk about some of the supporting documents that may have not been included, or some of his conclusions that he had not completely fleshed out, or even about what he did and why he did it. Instead, they want him to stay as narrow as humanly possible. And that is their argument.
Do you think that Mueller will answer questions with regard to whether or not the Attorney General misled the public on the findings?
No, I don't. I think, in fact, that what Bob Mueller will do is he will be true to that argument that he will stay within the document itself. He's not going to go beyond that in terms of his opinion. That being said, there is a lot in this document to discuss. And in fact, one of the problems, because the document is so big, so big, and there's so much in it, and things that this president did wrong. If the Democrats can organize themselves and actually cross-examine Bob Mueller, then they actually can get out the kind of information that they need if they do it right. If they do it poorly, all this will do is muddy the waters that much more and make it even more confusing for the American people.
What about the questions that are unanswered, like why he didn't follow through and personally interview the president during the investigation, or whether he was actually finished with his investigation or forced to shut it down?
I think he will talk about that to some degree. He was looking to interview the president, but we also are very, very aware that the president's lawyers work really, very hard to narrow the parameters in this case to the point that it would have been almost pointless, despite the president claiming that he said he would sit down with Bob Mueller again and again. So
it's pretty clear that there certainly is a group of Republicans that will look to try to also discredit Mueller and go after him about how this whole thing even started. Will they succeed, or do you think Mueller, who we hear is preparing and prepping for this, will be prepared and able to handle that?
Bob Mueller is a rock star. truly and honestly, when you look at his career and you look at his competency, his capability, he has appeared many times in front of Congress, and people have tried to go after him. Now, he's very organized, he's very thoughtful, and he will be aggressive if people cut him off. They will. I've seen him do it. And as a result of that, I think he's going to be thorough in terms of his answers. So you may get Republicans who are going to try to corner him into saying something that he doesn't want to say. I think that might be difficult for some of them, because if I had to put them side by side, I'd put Bob Mueller over most of them.
We understand that Mueller has a prepared opening statement that he has not shared with the Department of Justice. Do you think that'll just be more of what we've already heard from him?
I think it will be. But, you know, here's the thing. He's a private citizen. And as a private citizen, he has the ability to say just about anything that he wants to say. And the Department of Justice is likely to not even be in the room to stop him from saying it. And I think that one of the things that sometimes happens is people think about their legacy. And they think about what they want to leave behind. And I'm really curious to see if Bob Mueller decides that after all of his time, all of these efforts, all of the things that he saw, if he's going to sit down and simply lay out in a very clean way, like any prosecutor would, any good prosecutor, why this president was guilty of something. And that would all come from the report itself. Because I can tell you, as a former prosecutor myself, I can have a lot of documentation. What you do is you take all that you have and you boil down the significant points into a very simple and clean theme that you lay out. Bob Mueller could do that, and it would all be within the document, and there's nothing that DOJ could do about it. So it'll be really interesting to see what he does.
They literally needed to subpoena him to do this. He didn't even want to do it. Curious, though, why he wouldn't want to set the record straight after all that work that he put into this and the serious nature of what is in this report and how little the public really understands about it.
And it seems clear that his point was that I want the report to speak for itself. But what I think the American people should focus in on is Bob Mueller said that we would not charge a sitting president with obstruction. But what he didn't say is whether or not this person actually obstructed. That's the question that has to happen now, because Congress has an obligation to see if this rises to the level of crimes and misdemeanors. In other words, if this rises to the level of impeachment. And if they can get that information out of Bob Mueller, that could change everything.
All right. That is Central Intelligence, or former Central Intelligence Agency officer and criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Cambodia denies a secret naval base agreement with China. The U.S. will ramp up rapid deportations with a sweeping new rule. Turkey threatens an attack on Syrian Kurds as the U.S. envoy holds talks with Ankara. And could being distracted by your phone cause weight gain? Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, President Trump is rejecting a claim by Iran that it has arrested a number of 17 Iranians accused of spying on the country's nuclear and military sites for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency.
That's totally a false story. That's another lie. They put out propaganda. They put out lies.
Meanwhile, Britain's Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt says Britain is joining with European allies to respond to Iran's seizure of a UK-flagged oil tanker.
Because freedom of navigation is a vital interest of every nation, we will now seek to put together a European-led maritime protection mission to support safe passage of both crew and cargo in this vital region.
Iran's Revolutionary Guard seized the Steno Impero in the Strait of Hormuz on Friday. British Royal Marines seized an Iranian tanker off the coast of Gibraltar 2 weeks ago, but London said it was an act of state piracy. Joining us to talk about all of this is Benham Bentaleblou, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. So was Iran's, seizure of this UK oil tanker, was that just a tit for tat for what Britain did?
I think in the short term, there's a little bit of tit for tat there. Of course, there's a desire by Iran to make sure that the British know that there will be a price to be paid for adhering to some elements of the U.S. nice pressure campaign, adhering to a larger policy of pressure towards Iran, as well as to being tough on Iran. So I think there's a desire there to have the British also cease their current track, even though the British aren't really the big hawks on Iran, and then ultimately to show America that there will be a cost for the max pressure policy.
I would think, though, that they would want to sort of tread lightly with the Europeans, who are still somewhat looking to try to salvage the JCPOA.
That's an excellent question, but if passed as any prologue for the Iranians, they think they'll be able to get away with a lot more than the Europeans think they'll be able to get away with, because despite the nuclear violations that now exist on the Iranian side, the regime in Tehran remains wedded to the idea of keeping the nuclear deal alive only in part, incrementally violating its caps while growing its ability to escalate. And that growth in Iranian escalation is what Tehran is gambling will not drive the Europeans to embrace the Washington position. While I think some of America, myself included, think that if this escalation remains unchecked, then of course Europe will have to embrace the max pressure policy more openly and more firmly than ever expected.
What will or can Britain do in retaliation for this?
Well, I think, of course, there's a lot more diplomatic pressure they can levy onto the Iranians to get the ships to be released. There's any kind of open intelligence they have that they could publish to say, here's the chain of attributions, here's how we know the linkage is all the way to the top in Iran. Basically, make sure that the evidentiary statute is out there in the public for how they know that this is an act directed by the upper echelons of Iran's political and military elite. Third is, of course, for them to join what the U.S. is now calling for many to join, which is this maritime coalition that it would exist for the Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz to follow vessels that are flagged by foreign countries, to be able to make sure that tankers belonging to many countries around the world are able to traverse this important route safely, and to make sure that there is this continued freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf. So just beefing up their presence there would go a very, very long way.
How concerned are Iran's neighbors about the tensions that continue to rise?
I think Iran's neighbors remain exceptionally concerned, especially if you're looking at the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. In particular, yes, Saudi Arabia remains the outside hawk, followed by the UAE and several other states. But in general, that hawkishness is a response to kind of sustained Iranian behavior in the missile domain, the terrorism domain, in the militia domain. So these countries have many, many problems with Iran. And while they also don't want to go to war with Iran, they don't want a war with Iran, and they don't want Iran's behavior to continue unchecked. So there's a needle that they're beginning to thread very, very carefully here. And the question is, how long are they able to support the max pressure policy while they face diplomatic pressure from Tehran?
All right, that's Benham Bentaloglu. He is a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Later this morning, Britain will announce its new prime minister, who will formally take over on Wednesday to succeed Theresa May, who stepped down over her failure to get Parliament to ratify her Brexit deal. The only deal on the table has been rejected three times by Parliament and many lawmakers. Joining us from London is reporter Amy Gutman. Amy, from all the reports we're getting, it looks like London Mayor Boris Johnson is expected to be elected the leader of Britain's governing Conservative Party and, of course, the country's next prime minister, who is tasked with following through on this do-or-die pledge to deliver Brexit in just over 3 months. Is that what you're hearing about Boris Johnson?
That is the word on the street. That is the word everywhere. That's what everyone's been talking about for the last week. Plus, it's looking more and more like Boris Johnson as prime minister.
And how do you expect that this will impact Brexit?
Well, Boris Johnson is maligned by many European leaders. He's no friend of Europe. And part of this is because of his very combative and provocative personality. But part of this is also because we have to remember, he's been pro-Brexit all along. And many, in fact, believe that he masterminded his rise to power by encouraging former Prime Minister David Cameron to hold the Brexit referendum 3 years ago in the first place, which, of course, led to David Cameron's demise and has led to Theresa May's demise. And so it's all a bit Machiavellian or almost Shakespearean in a way. If you think about the many chess pieces here that have been moved and a three-year process for Boris Johnson to become prime minister, if this was his original intention. But despite all this, European leaders are also worried that Boris hasn't taken a no-deal outcome off the table. Now, this could be just a very shrewd negotiating tactic, because after all, if the UK doesn't do a deal with Europe, then the UK would essentially default on all of the big payments it still owes the EU. And the EU wants and needs that money. And so holding out like he has and saying that he's not going to take a no-deal possibility off the table does two things effectively. It keeps the fear factor up. It keeps the fear factor high, not only in the UK, but within the EU and these European country leaders. But it also basically puts him in a position of power because he's essentially saying to these other leaders, look, if you want a deal, you come to me. I'm not the desperate one here. You guys are the ones who are desperate for a deal. So you come to the table with an offer. So in a way, it is very shrewd on his part, and it's a completely different tactic to the one Theresa May took, which essentially had her going to the EU a time and again and again and again, and they simply wouldn't budge because they knew that she was desperate to do a deal.
Well, so is there a chance the UK might not leave the EU with Boris Johnson in charge?
There's always that chance. There's always the chance, but it's highly unlikely. Most people are speculating that Boris has no intention of settling on a no-deal outcome, and that really this is just posturing. It's also unlikely that there will be any kind of no-deal scenario. European leaders have been holding talks behind the scenes with Boris, even before it's been announced that he's prime minister, to allay these fears of a no-deal and to try to come to some kind of solution long before we hit the October deadline.
How are people dealing with the anticipation there? Is there a fear level?
It's all over the map. There are those who say that this paranoia that seems to have set in among some business leaders and some members of the public is simply that of course there's going to be a deal. In fact, there's talk that Parliament will prevent any no-deal outcome. And so I would say cooler heads are prevailing. There have been some reports that people who are diabetic are starting to hoard their insulin for fear that the borders will be held up. And certainly, wow, in a no-deal scenario, that could happen. There are warnings, and many of them are legitimate, that in the extreme event of a no-deal, there will be chaos at every border. And if you think about Britain's borders with France, with Ireland, this will be chaotic. The roads to Dover, Kent, you know, where we have the route to France, where the boats come in, bringing all this cargo, transporting all these goods. These are medicines. These are pharmaceutical products. These are food products. These are really vital products to, you know, making a nation operate and allowing people to function. And so some manufacturers are warning that a deal really needs to get hammered out quite quickly because already it's too late. Already it's going to take weeks, if not months, to put new systems and protocols in place. Just the taxes that need to be paid on goods when they cross a border. All of these protocols, all of these policies are up for grabs in terms of what are the new rules? Are there going to be different rules now for the UK? It used to be that we adhered to EU importing, exporting policies. Will we have our own policies now, or will we temporarily stick with the EU policies to buy time while we work out what those new policies are going to be? There's no answer. There's no rule book here. And so some of this panic and concern is understandably valid, but I think, again, cooler heads prevailing here. Highly unlikely that any leader or any parliament in the UK is going to allow the country to descend into complete chaos.
All right. That's London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Won't be long before we will know who is the next prime minister of Britain. Hundreds of thousands of people marched in San Juan Monday to demand Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rossello resign over leaked offensive chat messages of the governor and his inner circle. It's the latest scandal to hit a bankrupt island struggling to recover from 2017 hurricanes. Rossello's announcement on Sunday that he would not seek re-election next year and would step down as head of the new Progressive Party failed to appease the crowds who called for him to immediately surrender the governorship of the U.S. territory. It was the 10th straight day of protests. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Summer in the city is hot, but how hot? A team at the University of Georgia is developing a way to map out how hot it is in so-called urban heat islands down to the level of individual street blocks. Faith Lapidus reports.
On this hot afternoon, remote sensing scientist Deepak Mishra and his team are at the University of Georgia campus transit bus yard installing a temperature sensor on the front of a bus.
We are able to do this research because of the revolution in sensing technologies, the explosion in data science research.
At the peak of summer, about 30 buses will be similarly wired up.
We're collecting temperature data from these buses every 5 seconds as they go around the campus, go around the town.
Volunteers, mostly students, are pitching in too, with wearable sensors strapped to their backpacks and belts.
And then we start seeing how these temperatures are changing across town, which areas are consistently showing high temperatures, and what happens in the evening time, what happens in the night time.
32 is about 90 Fahrenheit.
With support from the National Science Foundation, the University of Georgia team is compiling highly detailed, fine-resolution maps showing what's called the urban heat island in their town of Athens, Georgia.
Heat is the leading weather killer. It kills more people every year than tornadoes, hurricanes, floods.
Scientists have known about the urban heat island effect for decades, making maps from satellite data. Heat islands are urban areas that are hotter than their less developed surroundings, mostly because they're largely devoid of trees. Dark surfaces like roads and rooftops absorb heat and radiate it back out. Some parts of a city can be as much as 15 degrees hotter than others.
This project is going beyond that to see what is happening within the urban heat island.
Geographer Andrew Grunstein studies how weather and climate affect human health. He says hyperlocal heat maps could save lives by pinpointing pockets of extreme heat.
Heat stroke is the most serious heat thing. Your organs can shut down. It can be life-threatening. So we really want to prevent people from getting to that point.
Especially at risk are the elderly, children, athletes, people with chronic medical conditions like diabetes, and those who do physical labor outside.
People that, say, can't afford air conditioning or don't have air conditioning can be at risk. Some research shows that poor communities are often in hotter parts of cities because they don't have as much green space.
This project in Athens is a small-scale experiment, but Mishra expects that these heat maps will be commonplace in the future. City planners will use them to decide where to plant trees. Communities can use them to make sure people at risk have access to water and air-conditioned spaces.
I see a day when people have this app in their phone, and then the phone tells them, take this route, you'll be less exposed to urban heat.
Using data to drive better decision-making when the heat is on. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Art Neville, a member of a storied New Orleans musical family who performed with his siblings in the Neville Brothers Band and founded the groundbreaking funk group The Meters, died today. The artist, whose nickname was Papa Funk, was 81 years old. Neville's manager said he died at his home. Cause of death not yet available, but Neville did battle with a number of health issues, including complications from back surgery. The Neville brothers spent some of their childhood in the now demolished Calliope housing project in New Orleans, and some at a family home in uptown New Orleans. In a 2003 interview with Offbeat magazine, Art Neville described going to a Methodist church as a child where he had his first encounter with a keyboard. And that experience helped kick off a lifelong career as a keyboardist and vocalist. In 1954. Neville was in high school when he sang the lead on the Hawkettes remake of a country song called Mardi Gras Mambo. He told the public radio show American Roots how he was recruited by the Hawkettes, saying he had no idea how they found out where he lived, but they needed a piano player, and they came right up to his house and asked his mother and father if he could go. More than 60 years later, the song remains a staple of the carnival season, but that longevity never translated into financial success for Art Neville, who received no money for it. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 1, 2018, 4 cases of Ebola virus disease were confirmed in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC. Since then, health officials have reported at least 2,408 confirmed and probable cases of Ebola in the country's North Kivu and Ituri provinces. Over 1,600 people have died. To date, this is the worst Ebola epidemic recorded in the DRC and the second largest recorded outbreak of the disease globally. The United States quickly responded to the new health emergency. In September 2018, just about 1 month after the new outbreak was confirmed in the DRC, the United States declared the outbreak an emergency and bolstered its support by deploying a Disaster Assistance Response Team, or DART, to the DRC. Comprised of disaster and health experts from the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the DART team began to coordinate the U.S. government response to the outbreak, while working closely with local officials, the international community, and relief agencies. In June 2019, USAID Administrator Mark Green and U.S. Ambassador to the DRC Michael Hammer traveled to North Kivu Province, where they met with healthcare workers at an Ebola treatment unit in Katwa, community and local leaders at the Emergency Operations Center in Butembo, and response groups working to stop the spread of the disease. Following Administrator Green's visit, USAID announced publicly it has provided $98 million thus far to help the Democratic Republic of the Congo and international partners fight the Ebola outbreak. The funds are going toward life-saving assistance such as infection prevention and control activities, training for healthcare workers, community engagement interventions, promotion of safe and dignified burials, and food assistance for people and communities affected by Ebola. This assistance is also helping to prepare communities in Goma, the capital of North Kivu Province, and other neighboring areas of the DRC at high risk for Ebola spread. The way that you defeat this deadly virus is to harness the strength, the connections, and the spirit of every part of the community. Every part of the community is affected. Every part of the community must be in the response. And that is, to me, the most important thing, said USAID Administrator Green. With all of the challenges, and there are many, there is nothing that is insurmountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.